Well, this is Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and they're the views of our guest. And for the next hour, the guest is going to be Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. And we're going to be talking about the Constitution. Well, really, this evening we're going to be talking about the concept of jury nullification. Down through the ages, of course, the basic struggle has been between those who want to rule the people and the people who want to be free. And, of course, never before America has there ever been a system quite like ours where the power of the government was to be restricted by the chains of the Constitution. There was very little that the federal government could do. Had nothing to do at all with the individual, couldn't tax the individual, couldn't tell the individual what to do or where to live. But of course, there are always those on the other side who want to tell people, who want to control other people. There is this inherent desire on the side of some people to be the aristocrats who will rule the common folks. Well, one of the barriers that was put in the way of misuse of power was the jury system in the United States. And the idea that the ultimate arbiter of what the law was, and indeed of what the Constitution said, was not the judge, and was not the prosecutor, and was not the district attorney. It was the jury. And they would have the right, if they disagreed with the law, if they disagreed with the judge, to actually nullify the instructions that were given to them. Now, the judges don't want that. They want to be able to run the court, and they want to really determine who's going to get convicted and who's going to go innocent. And many, many times in small communities, why there's the judges and the attorneys, and certainly both on both sides, work this thing and have it all laid out ahead of time, and the concepts of justice are simply lost on the wayside. But there still is this process of the jury, and the jury is one of the most powerful organizations in America today. With that as the background, David, you go ahead and pick up the story.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. And it's a privilege to be on your show and to share these truths, because this is probably the only place in the country where these sort of things are going to be heard. As we seek to restore the republic, we recognize that most media outlets are not going to breathe a word about this, and most people, of course, will never hear about it in any public institution, such as the school system or the legal system. And so we're grateful for the opportunity to get this word out across America. You know, our founders clearly understood that you cannot trust any one person or even group of people with power that's unchecked. For example, in Federalist Paper 51, they said the concept of countervailing ambitions, as well as the constitutional framework of opposite and rival interests, was designed to prevent tyranny. Each branch of government, as well as each level of government, is given power to serve as a check on the other branch or level of civil government. Of course, most people think of three branches and recognize, oh yes, there's three branches that are a check and balance against one another, legislative, executive, and judicial. And then most people haven't heard that there's four levels of government. There's a federal level, state level, a county level, and then the local level. And each of these four levels, the Federalist 51 is saying, are to be a check against one another. But as you mentioned, there's one, and you almost might call it another entire branch of government, that is a check on the whole system. And that is the jury. The power of the jury to stop injustice was something our founders valued very, very greatly.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment with Pastor David Whitney of the Institute on the Constitution. Well, David, go right ahead.
Many people in America today recognize that one of the greatest threats to our freedom and liberty is a judiciary that's just way, way out of control. It's way overboard. And there's a number of books out today with things like judicial tyranny as their title, or the imperial judiciary. So many people in America recognize there's an enormous problem in the courtroom, and that the judges basically are running roughshod over the rights of citizens and ignoring the law, misinterpreting the law left and right, twisting it around, and whether it's at the Supreme Court level or other federal courts or even state court levels. And so there's a widespread recognition that in America today, justice is often not done in the court system. In fact, most people know that, well, you wind up being dragged into court, the only thing that's going to happen is you're going to lose your shirt, and then maybe more than your shirt. Maybe you're going to lose your whole wardrobe or whatever, but you're not likely to see justice done for you in the court of law. That's not to say that it's never done, but justice has become a rarity in the court of law, and I think in the minds of most Americans. So, you know, most Americans try to steer clear of the judicial system whenever possible. The odd thing is that kind of counter system has risen up. You see it on television, the fascination people have. I haven't watched them because they're about worth watching, but these judge shows where, I don't know whether the person's actually been a judge in the past or not, but they elevate to them this place, and people come in to have this judge decide their issue. And you see that in those judge shows that seem to be popular, because they're cropping up all over the place, so there must be people watching them, or they wouldn't be putting them on. There's no jury in that room. It's the judge that makes the full determination as to what justice is and how each party is going to be dealt with. And, you know, I guess they try to be humorous or whatever to keep an audience. But so many people have been developing, and I think this perhaps is on purpose on the part of the media, have been developing a negative view of the jury. I think there's a number of cases that have taken place that show that the jury is often making decisions that, you know, the rest of the country would say, boy, that's unwise, and whether it's the O.J. trial, or I think of this gal, Stella Liebeck, a number of years back, who bought a coffee at McDonald's in her vehicle and then drove away, leaving the coffee in her lap, and if I understand the details, remove the top off the cup, top of the cup of coffee off, and then spilled the coffee in her lap, burning herself very severely, very painfully, and then the jury awarded her one point, I think it was $9 million, some outrageous sum. And
hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Pastor David Whitney. David's talking about the judicial system and certainly many times why there's an effort to portray the jury as certainly not being very smart or dependable. And there's some shows that I will have to admit that do give certainly, I think, a very good appraisal of the relationship between the judge and the jury. But I think one of the problems we have in our society is that we do have some judges who certainly do not have a sense of justice. Simply they're there to work as part of a system. And if you notice, for instance, in the so many of our courts, why you have a flag, and instead of being an American flag, it's a flag with a gold embroidered border on it. Now that is not an American flag. That is an Admiralty flag. Very decorative, gold border on it. But you have to understand that in many of our courts, we do not have constitutional law. We have admiralty law, and that's how one of the ways you can tell it is an admiralty court, because it's an admiralty flag. And there, of course, you are not under the Constitution. You're under really the rule of the judge. As when you are, of course, tried at sea, you're under the rule of the admiral or of the captain of the ship. People do not understand that there are different types of law in our country, and of course do not understand the importance of having a jury that can determine not only what they're told, but can determine whether the law is accurate or not. I was recently at a call for jury duty, and the judge told the potential jurors, we don't want you going to the law library. We don't want you questioning what the law is. The law is what I tell you it is. Is that agreeable to you? Well, of course, that's not the way our law system is set up. Actually, the law is not what the judge says. The law is determined by the jury. That is what jury nullification is all about. And with that as the background, David, you pick up the story.
And Dr. Stan, your experience there in court is not at all unusual as a juror being told, don't you dare think about determining the law or judging the law for yourself. And yet we'll show in the course of several times together looking at the material of the history of our country and the background and what our founders had to say, that is exactly what the jury is supposed to be doing, judging the law as well as the facts in a case in order to do justice. And so one of the problems that we recognize here at Institute on the Constitution, of course, we're teaching people the U.S. Constitution. We've begun state constitution courses, and we have one completed for Maryland and have some folks working on ones for California and Virginia and other states. But how do we as people enforce our Constitution? When we teach our course at Institute on the Constitution, on the U.S. Constitution as well as the Maryland State Constitution, part of the course is simply recognizing that more than 90% of what's done in Washington, D.C., and in Maryland done in our state capital is a violation of the Constitution. These people swore an oath before Almighty God to uphold the Constitution, and they're going to answer for that, by the way, on Judgment Day. And they'll be held to pay for all eternity for those who took an oath and then just threw the oath off as if it meant nothing, because they made an oath before Almighty God, and they're going to have to answer before Almighty God for that. But short of Judgment Day, which is in God's hands, what can we the people do to enforce our Constitution? It's our contract with our civil government, whether at the federal level or the state level. If we understand they're breaking our contract, sure, we can go to the ballot box and try to vote them out of office and vote for somebody who will uphold the Constitution. But there's an additional power we have, an additional two votes, actually, that we have in addition to the ballot box, and that is the vote on a grand jury and the vote on a petit jury that are very powerful in order to enforce our Constitution, enforce our contract when the government, the civil government, breaks that contract. And that's why here at Institute on the Constitution, we determined that one of the courses that we needed to add to what we're already doing is a course training people on the duty of the jury. And kind of the slogan for this course is that the duty of the jury is to defend the Constitution by judging the law as well as the facts in a case. And this course is designed to train you in what you need to know as a juror to do that job, and also train you to be skillful and wise enough to avoid the kind of judge that you encountered who's going to want to find out who holds these views and eject them from the potential serving on a particular case. And often judges and attorneys will do this. They'll ask questions designed to ferret out anybody that believes in this jury nullification idea, and they'll see that they're removed from the jury because they don't want anybody judging the law. That's not universal in terms of every court and every judge, but it's prevalent enough across our country that I think people need to be aware of the situation and aware of how to wisely and craftily handle themselves in that situation in order to be able to serve, in order to be able to see that justice is done, in order to be able to defend our Constitution against those who are egregiously violating the Constitution and otherwise would be getting away with doing that. Well, in order to do justice in our legal system, we need to know what that standard is, and we need to really understand our founders' view of justice is rooted in God's Word, God's law, the Bible. George Washington said that the two pillars, essential pillars for our country's continuance, is religion and morality. And, of course, by religion he meant Christianity. Or you could take what our second president said, John Adams, that our Constitution's made only for a moral and religious people. By religious, of course, he meant Christian. A moral and religious people is wholly inadequate for the governance of any other. And so these people understood that true justice is only fulfilled when God's law is obeyed. That's the bottom line. You've got to have God's law and seek to fulfill God's law for there to be justice. And the scriptures speak very clearly to this. For example, the Epistle of James in chapter 4, verse 12, says that there is only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and destroy. only one lawgiver, only one judge, and that's the Lord God himself. And therefore, any human beings that want to speak of law that is truly lawful, or justice or judgment that's truly just, they must comport what they do, any law that they write, with that one lawgiver and with that one judge. So our founders said very clearly in the Declaration of Independence that the just cause for which they were fighting the war for independence was the laws of nature and nature's God. There was an absolute standard of justice, and they found it in God's Word, the Bible, and it was that absolute standard of justice in the Declaration of Independence by which they measured King George III and his government and his violation of the laws of nature and nature's God and his violation of the rights of Englishmen that were given to those Englishmen not by King George III, but by God. And so there is an absolute standard, and that standard is given to us in God's Word. And when we think of the biggest or most important compilation of that, that has many extended details beyond it, it's the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments given to us in Exodus 20 fell out in the sum of the moral law, is how John Witherspoon, a signer of our Declaration of Independence, one of the most influential founders because of his teaching at the College of New Jersey, which ultimately became Princeton University. He influenced major movers in the foundation of our country, like James Madison, the father of our Constitution, studied under Witherspoon, and many others who were influential in the founding of our country. But he said the Ten Commandments, that John Witherspoon said the Ten Commandments are the sum of moral law. You want to know what's a just law, you want to know what's a true law, you go back to the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments says things like, thou shalt not steal. That is, God has given to every human being made in his image a right to own property. That's on the small level of a little child, fighting over a toy, and one child says to the other, it's mine. Some of the first words out of a young kid's mouth, it's mine. I possess this property, I own this property, and you can only use it if I give you permission to use it, because I am the owner of it. It goes all the way up to owning a piece of real estate. Thou shalt not steal real estate. The proper and rightful owner is the person who paid for it and holds the title of that because they have actually paid for it. And nobody has permission to steal that property from them, in spite of what some black robe lawyer says. And that's what the Supreme Court said in Kelo v. New London. Yes, it is okay to steal another person's property, provided the thieving person, or persons, I guess you should say, happen to be a government agency or a government jurisdiction, such as a city, in that case, New London, Connecticut, saying, yeah, New London, Connecticut can steal the property of anybody in its boundaries, because we, the Supreme Court, have determined that thou shalt not steal no longer applies to civil government. Anybody else, it still applies to you. You better not steal your neighbor's property or we'll put you in jail. But government now can steal your property, and that's just fine. Did they change the law? No. They broke the law of God. They violated the law of God. They violated what is true law, and what they created instead is really no law at all. It's a violation. It's tyranny. And that's what happens when human beings collectively together as a governmental institution, when they collectively violate God's law, you don't have freedom, you have tyranny.
I think it's important for our listeners to understand that David's talking about this idea of taking property under eminent domain, which certainly is acknowledged that what we should be able to do is take property if it's going to be used for maybe a schoolyard or for a highway, but to be able to take property from one person and give it to another so that they can develop perhaps a hotel on that land, or give it to a developer so they can develop the land and make more money and bring in more taxes. But ordinarily, of course, the developer usually has been very, very free with gifts to the politicians who are making these decisions. And all across America, politicians, local politicians, are taking away people's land to give it to their friends. And that just isn't right. We'll be right back. Go right ahead.
And so the Ten Commandments, really, if we study each of them carefully, we could see how those laws apply in a multitude of areas in life. And that's a true justice system. When God's law is applied and enforced in a civil society, then everyone's rights that are given to them by God are protected. And as the Declaration of Independence said, that's the whole purpose of government anyway, to protect and secure your God-given rights. And when government fails and no longer does that, it no longer protects your God-given rights, then you have another God-given right to change that form of government, to secure a form of government that will protect your God-given rights.
Well, yeah, we have a caller. Ordinarily, we don't like to take calls when we have you on, but here's a gentleman from Pennsylvania who has some experiences in trying to get a jury nullification. So why don't we go ahead and talk to Fred, who's from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hi, Fred. How are you doing?
Good evening, Fred.
Hi.
Why don't you tell us about your experience? Were you on the jury?
Well, I was until I insisted on my right to vote my conscience.
Now,
in September 03 and also in the summer 07, I keep seeming to be picked over and over again, even though I say that I do have that right, and I am not seated, but I do have that right, and I insist on having a hearing with the judge and a few of the other people in court in private. And when I do get that hearing, I basically lay out how I feel about it and what I feel are my rights to vote my conscience,
and so
that
what
includes past judgment on the law that is being supposedly violated.
Well, Fred, what did the judge say when you told him that you had a right, and the jury had a right to nullify the law, or nullify the decision?
Well, the first time, basically, the judge, a woman judge, started to fly off the handle, and she seemed to interpret that as not being able to live with her authority or live under her authority while the case was being heard, and that's not what I had objected. Second time, the judge was an older man. And he listened carefully, but he did say that without going into it, he quietly excused me from it. After I had that that hearing alone with the judge in court.
And so all of this was in the jury selection process.
Yes, I had thought about hiding how I felt about it and staying in the jury room and trying to pull the other people over to my philosophy of it, but I really don't think that's wise.
I don't think it is either, Fred. I think you handled it just as you should, and I think that what you need to do is help us get the information out.
Well, you know what I would like to do? The second time I asked whether all of that, all of my testimony, I could get that in writing, and the judge said yes. You can. If I know what question to ask, you know, what hearing it was, I can get that, all of that, and I could, you know, make a book out of that.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We just had a conversation with Fred from Philadelphia, who has been picked twice to be on a jury, but of course he never actually got onto the jury because each time he let the judge know that he believed in this concept of jury nullification. Now, the judges know about that, but you see, it questions their authority. It keeps them from being able to direct the ultimate decision of the jury, and this is really what's wrong about it. The tradition of America was the fact that we were going to be able to have juries that would determine what was legal and what was not. Thanks very much for calling, Fred. We're going to get right back here to David Whitney. Go ahead, David.
Yes, in the course we've put together here at Institute on Constitution, our Duty of the Jury course, we're actually in the process of filming it now, and we're sharing it with you on the radio. But we'll talk about the history that's helpful to know because some of these judges have heard of cases like Peter Zenger and William Penn. Obviously, in Philadelphia, they ought to know about William Penn, and they ought to know about his jury that actually nullified the law against William Penn that kept Penn in prison before he came and founded Pennsylvania. Very interesting cases, because those cases, these people hear about it, and they know about it. And if more Americans knew this, they would know that the current trend of judges desiring no jury nullification to take place is contrary to the foundation of our very country, contrary to what our founders themselves said, and contrary to what even the Supreme Court admits. Some of the most recent cases, 1986, the Supreme Court admits that the jury has the power to nullify the law. They don't use those exact terms, but as we go through this course, we'll reveal that, and part of our purpose in this course is to give people the ammunition they need to defeat the arguments of these people who are rejecting the history, the tradition, and what our legal system has actually said very clearly, very plainly, that the average person is never going to hear in any other context, which is why, again, we have put this course together, because we believe it's very important that the word get out. And in a place like Philadelphia, where William Penn, he'd be turning over in his grave, because he would never have come and never been able to found Pennsylvania had not several jurors stood against the judge at very great cost to themselves and great expense, and they refused to do what the judge told them to do. They refused to convict William Penn. So sad to see that Philadelphia now does the exact opposite, and they'd be putting William Penn in jail for the rest of his life, as was attempted by the judges in England back in those days. Well, if we were to go back to the Ten Commandments and understand that that is the sum of the moral law, Jesus actually gave a summation of that law when he was asked a trick question, and this was a lawyer trying to trap Jesus into a corner with his question, and he asked, which is the first commandment of all? In other words, what's the most important of all the commandments? And Jesus answered him, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And that is the second greatest commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. And so Jesus summarized the two tables of the law. The first half has to do with honoring God, loving God with all our being, and the second half, loving our neighbor as ourselves. So for example, we talked about thou shalt not steal. If you love your neighbor as yourself, you won't steal his property. And all of the second table of the law relates in a similar way. So Jesus summarized that the greatest law is to love God, the second greatest is to love your neighbor as yourself. And so this is the foundation that our founders had in their thinking as they structured our judicial system. In fact, as they structured the entire civil government, they were doing so with a biblical frame of reference, that is, with a biblical worldview of what the Bible said about law and government. Consider the fact that we have three branches of government. In the day of our founders, there was an unequal way in which the three branches were handled in England. You know, the king had enormous powers, and Parliament, kind of the legislative branch, had lesser powers, and the judiciary really had very little power. They're kind of lackeys of the king. They were not three equal branches of government. But our founders understood what the Word of God says in Isaiah 33 and verse 22. Isaiah 33, 22 gives us the structure that our founders used for civil government. And it says, for the Lord is our judge. The Lord is our lawgiver. The Lord is our king. He will save us. So there you have the three branches of government, judicial, legislative, and executive. And the Lord is over each one of them. In other words, they're all equal. There's no subservience of one to the other. And the theory that they developed as they put this together is therefore there are to be three equal branches of government that are independent in some sense from each other and that serve as check and balance against one another, because obviously human beings are not God. They're fallen and fallible, and no one can be trusted with unlimited power.
And I think certainly the Congress can limit the courts. The courts can limit Congress. The executive can veto the laws passed by the legislature, and the legislature can override the veto. It's all a matter of checks and balances. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest, Pastor David Whitney. We're talking about the Constitution, and it is so vitally important that our listeners understand the foundation of our freedom. Because if you don't understand our Constitution, there's no way that you're going to be able to be effective in this battle to preserve our heritage for generations yet unborn. So go right ahead, David.
Well, the laws of nature and nature's God, as they expressed in the Declaration, they're the foundation of all civil law in our government. And the Scripture explains this very clearly in terms of the role the civil magistrate plays. And Romans 13 is where it expounds it most clearly. For rulers, it says, are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is, that is the civil magistrate, he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Therefore you must be subject not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. And because of this you also pay taxes, for they are God's ministers attending continually to this very thing. Three times here in the passage of Romans 13, it's explained that the civil magistrate is God's minister. As God's minister, therefore, they are subject to the law of God. That is, they cannot act outside, they cannot justly act outside and be a minister of God and not administer God's law. They cannot justly say, I'm going to change the laws regarding theft, and some theft is going to be permissible. They can't do that and become a minister of God. They have become a minister of Satan, because those are the only two options. You're either serving the Lord or you're serving Satan. You're either a minister of God or a minister of Satan. And just because someone is in a position of authority, and by the way, this is the misinterpretation I'm going to share with you here at this moment. The misinterpretation of Romans 13 is to say that anybody who is in authority is his authority is never to be questioned, never to be challenged, because God's put him in that position of authority, and he's God's minister no matter what he does. Well, on that theory, you would say that Adolf Hitler was a minister of God, Stalin was a minister of God, Pol Pot and all the other evil tyrants who murdered their own people were ministers of God. No, they are not, and we know that because in Scripture it's very clear that we are not to obey commands given to us that violate God's law, just as Daniel did not obey the command of the king not to pray, and so he was thrown in the lion's den. And his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they did not obey the command of the king to bow
down
and worship.
Hold that thought, David. We'll be right back here in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Pastor David Whitney. We were just talking about Romans 13, the misuse of Romans 13, and certainly we are not to obey ungodly men. They may be in the positions of authority, but there, certainly, if a man is subservient to God, and he has been placed over us, then we should be subservient to him. But if he is certainly an evil and wicked individual, oh, we would certainly not be serving our Lord if we were to be subservient to him. And believe me, ladies and gentlemen, the government, even today, the Home Office of Homeland Security, is telling ministers, and actually in cases of some sort of a political crisis or a crisis in America, to begin preaching Romans 13 to their flock so that the people will go along with the government no matter what the government tells them. It's exactly what happened in Adolf Hitler's Germany. If you have not yet read Erwin Lutzer's wonderful book, Hitler's Cross, we carry it. Erwin Lutzer is senior pastor at the Moody Church in Chicago, and in his book, Romans 13, he tells how the ministers in Hitler's Germany were also told to preach Romans 13 to keep the people in line. In other words, to use the ministers to control the people so that, of course, the tyrannical state could impose the programs that they wanted, and there'd be no opposition from the good people who should have been up there demonstrating and saying, we're not going to go along with Adolf Hitler because he's a corrupt and evil man, and the Nazi movement is corrupt and evil. But you see, they didn't. And so many of them, of course, marched off peacefully to the concentration camps and their death. Well, our telephone number, of course, we're not going to put out because we want to hear what Pastor Whitney says. But before we go on, David, I want you to get out your telephone number. I want you, of course, to get out your website so people will know how to get in touch with the Institute of the Constitution. And when are they going to be able to learn about jury nullification? Do you actually have that program completed?
Yes, actually, we're in the midst of filming our jury nullification course, and hoping you'll hear it's March, hoping that by summer, or maybe the end of summer, I'm not exactly sure the timing, but that we'll have that course completed and available to people to purchase with DVDs and a student notebook and a host manual so that they can conduct this class in their community, where it'll be a turnkey program, just like our Foundations course that teaches the U.S. Constitution, Bill of Rights, and Declaration, that makes it very simple for anyone without any background or training that to put the course on in their community and communicate these truths to people in their church, people who are using our curriculum often for homeschooling, as well as just sharing it with their neighbors in their living room, or sometimes people will rent a room down in the hotel and gather a group of people from the community together. Many different ways to get the message out. And you can contact us to purchase a host kit for the U.S. Constitution. That's our Foundations course. You can call us if you want to order that or any of the other materials we offer. And our toll-free number at Institute on the Constitution is 866-730-9796. That toll-free number again for Institute on the Constitution is 866-730-9796. Or if you want to order it online, and of course we're on the East Coast, so our office hours are the opposite there of the West Coast, but if you want to order online and go to our online store, that's available at iotconline.com. Institute on the Constitution's website again is iotconline.com. And go to the bookstore. There's many resources available in addition to our host kit that teaches the U.S. Constitution. There's lectures that we do on a monthly basis dealing with various application issues of how the Constitution applies to various sections of our society and issues in our society today, and other resources, a lecture I've done there on why no church should ever be a 501c3 or incorporated church. If it does, it puts itself under the control of the state or under the control of the IRS. And that's a resource that I think will help pastors as well as lay people think through as to why their church needs to be separate from the state and not under the thumb of the state. So those are just some of the resources that people can avail themselves in our web store, and that's at iotconline.com.
And I just would mention for our listeners out there that Radio Liberty, my ministry, is not a 501c3. We had a 501c3. We gave it up because we wanted to be able to tell you the truth, and we did not want to have to restrict what we said for fear of government interference. I know other ministries similar to ours, Tex Mars for one of them, actually, of course, got visited by the IRS and had their 501c3 status taken away from them. Why? Because they told the truth on the radio, and I think that Tex Mars had referred to President Clinton as a crook. The IRS came and said, you cannot do that, and Tex Mars said, what do you mean I can't do that? He's been indicted, he's been impeached by the House of Representatives, for lying and for supporting perjury and for suddenly perjuring himself. And of course, they said, well, it may be true, but you can't say it because you're 501c3. And so they took away Ted's, Mars' 501c3 status. Well, we don't have 501c3 status. We want to be able to tell you the truth. And I do hope that our listeners out there will appreciate that and will support us accordingly. And certainly I agree with what Pastor Whitney says. No church should be a 501c3. Pick the story up there, Dave.
Yes, I thank you for taking that stand for your ministry, because if churches do that, then they're accepting a gag from the government as to what they can or cannot say. Well, going back to the idea of Romans 13, repeated there three times very clearly, the civil magistrate is God's minister, and the term for minister there is diakonos, the Greek term that we derive our English term deacon from. Think of a deacon in a church. I know in Baptist churches, a deacon is a very high-level position, basically like an elder. Other churches may be a little lower than that, but a highly respected Christian leader is what a deacon is. Well, God's deacon is what a civil magistrate, a proper civil magistrate is. He's God's deacon, And obviously, as God's minister, he's subject himself to the law of God. His system of government, in order to be just, must be following the law of God, because justice, we know, is defined by God's law. That is, if it's in accordance with God's law, it's just. If it's not in accordance with God's law, it's not just. You see, from the very beginning of the universe, this has been Satan's plan to undermine God's law, to undermine the idea that there is absolute standard of right and wrong given to us by God. Consider in the Garden of Eden what he approached Eve with and ultimately tempted Adam with as well. Of course, Adam and Eve were told that they were not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They could eat of any other trees, but not that one of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And Satan came along to tempt them, and his temptation was actually to tempt them to overthrow the law of God. To take of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was to overthrow the law of God and establish oneself to be independent of God, like God, determining what is right and what is wrong on your own. Only God can tell us what's right and what is wrong. Only God can tell us 2 plus 2 equals 4, always equals 4, never changes from equaling 4. He designed that law into the universe, therefore it's an unchangeable law. What many people don't understand is that just as the physical and chemical and mathematical laws of the universe are fixed and unchanging, so is the moral law of the universe fixed and unchanging. The Ten Commandments do not change just because they were issued by God in Mount Sinai 4,000 years ago. That doesn't change them at all. They are fixed, unchanging, and they shall never change. So the temptation was really to establish themselves as an independent moral authority, free from the law of God, and free to establish right and wrong by their own standard, determine what's just by their own thinking. Isn't that true of what's done today? Here in Maryland, the Senate just voted a bill in that would basically redefine marriage as any two cohabitating adults, same sex, opposite sex, whatever, you know, that just throw the door open to redefine marriage here in the state. That's throwing the God's law out the door and saying we are the ones who determine what is just and what is right. We're the ones to define marriage. Oh, no, you don't. No society can change that marriage is between one man and one woman. If they do, they have not changed the law any more than they can change the law of 2 plus 2 equals 4. They're fools to think they can stand against the God who created the universe and shake their fist and spit in his eye and get away with it. They'll be judged, and the society that accepts their wicked decisions will also be judged, and ultimately, like all the, on the ash heap of history of every nation that's gone down the road of rejecting God's law, it is ultimately destroyed, and it does not rise again from the dust. And God issued a very stern warning in the Old Testament. The Old Testament prophet Isaiah spoke these words in Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. And that's what happens whenever any human being, independent of God's law, thinks they're going to establish what's just in their own mind. They turn things on their head, and sweet for bitter, bitter for sweet, darkness for light, and that is so much what is happening in our legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government today. Redefining everything and making what was evil and wicked now good. And to do this is to really make government a joke, because then what is right and what is wrong is simply changing every day. So yesterday the actions you did are now a criminal action, or vice versa. What was a criminal action is no longer. You know, the whole thing becomes topsy-turvy, and nobody has any security, because you don't know what, from day to day, what the law is going to be. It's changing under your very, very feet, like an earthquake taking place all the time. A moral and legal earthquake is really a good picture of what America is like today. Nobody has any stable ground, and everything's coming crumbling down if we allow such evil to continue. Well, our United States Constitution, based upon this biblical worldview, therefore had a realistic view of human nature. And there's two very important things our founders derived from the Bible about human nature that were the foundation of their legal system. First is that all men are created in the image of God. Only mankind, not cats, dogs, animals of any other type, not insects, not birds, only mankind bears the image of God. And therefore, mankind has a very special dignity. Mankind has rights that are endowed by the Creator upon him as a being made in the image of God. Therefore, all human beings are equal in the sense that they're to be treated equitably before a judge. That doesn't mean they're all equal in terms that they all ought to have equal living standards or income. No, not equal in that sense, which is often the misinterpretation and twisting of our day. But no, in terms of justice, in terms of the legal system, they are all to be treated equitably before a judge. No one is to be discriminated against because of their race, because of their heritage, because of their family, or anything like that. For example, the command was given in Deuteronomy to the people of Israel, Deuteronomy 16, verses 19 and 20, "You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality, nor take a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. You shall follow what is altogether just, that you may live and inherit the land which the Lord your God is giving you." And so all human beings made in the image of God are to be treated equitably in the court of justice. And this is essentially the purpose for which our government was established. It's stated right there in the preamble of the U.S. Constitution. The purpose of the Constitution was to establish justice. And the question that should come to everyone's mind, well, how do you know what is justice? For our founders, you turn back to the Declaration of Independence. You read the laws of nature and nature's God. That tells us what's justice. What's that mean? It means the Bible. God's Word is the standard of what is just and what is unjust. So the essential purpose for our legal system is to establish justice. And the Declaration of Independence is essentially part of the law of America. I debated a history professor here in Maryland who wanted to create this great divide, a kind of great canyon, Grand Canyon, between the time of the Declaration and the time of the Constitution. And the Declaration has nothing to do with the Constitution. These people have to argue that because they are rejecting what the foundation is of our country. And if they accept the Declaration, they realize the Constitution really means that the laws of nature, nature's God, the Bible, is the standard of justice. But if you open the U.S. Code, it states that the organic laws of the United States includes the Declaration of Independence. It's right there at the beginning of the U.S. Code, because the Declaration states the very purpose for which civil government was formed, which is to secure our God-given rights and liberties that come to us as human beings created by our God, who created the entire universe and gave dignity to us as his image bearers. So that's the first thing. All men are image bearers of God, of the divine nature. Then secondly, however, the opposite truth is that all men are fallen creatures. We all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, Romans 3:23 says. And therefore, there exists a need for government. People need government because they're sinners. Today, there's a very popular movement among many young people, an anarchist movement. I stumbled across a website here, and there's some good things he had to say on it, but he called it the No State blog or what have you. In other words, he's advocating for anarchy. No government whatsoever. Well, that's a nice idea, but it doesn't work in practical reality because all human beings are sinners. It would only work if all human beings were perfect and never did anything wrong. All human beings are sinners, and therefore, as we saw back in our brief study of Romans 13, the biblical purpose for civil government is to punish the sinners, punish the evildoers, and protect the righteous. And 1 Peter 2:13-14 expresses this very clearly as well, that government exists for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do good. And many would say, well, David, that's a nice theory you're presenting, but our founders really didn't believe that. Oh, yes, they did. Turn to what James Madison, the father of our Constitution, said in Federalist Paper number 55. He said, "As there is a degree of depravity in mankind," notice that word, He said, mankind are depraved. That is, they're fallen, sinful creatures. There's a degree of depravity in mankind which requires a certain degree of circumspection and distrust. That is, you cannot trust anybody with power because they're depraved. They're fallen creatures. And so then he continues, so there are other qualities in human nature which justify a certain portion of esteem and confidence. Republican, that's small r, not the party, but the form of government. Republican government presupposes the existence of these qualities in a higher degree than any other form. That is, presupposes that man is a fallen creature, but man is also made in the image of God.
Well, David, we're out of time, so our guest this evening has been Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. Certainly these classes are being put on all across the land. What we need are more and more people willing to take the time to begin to teach the Constitution so people will understand the source of our freedom. Well, David, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. And, you know, let me give one more quote from James Madison, and this is Federalist Paper 51, which, again, emphasizes, and this is the thing, that if people were to actually read what our founders said, they would discover it's a biblical worldview of law and government that our founders clearly believed in, that was the basis for the structure of government they're giving us. And the reason I'm giving this background is that it's important to understand these principles as a juror in order to be able to make a decision about a piece of legislation, a piece of law that's being used to charge someone with a so-called crime. You have to judge that law. The most important question to ask is by what standard you must judge it. The standard our founders used is the laws of nature and nature's God. Well, James Madison in Federalist Paper 51 said, the need for government flows from the fact that all men are fallen creatures with a sinful nature. Wow, he couldn't be any more clear. He's quoting the Bible. He's stating theologically what's absolutely clear. And then he says, but what is government itself? But the greatest of all reflections on human nature. If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. That is, the people in government would be perfect. They would never sin. He continues, in framing a government which is to be administered by men, instead of by angels, by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it, that is the government, to control itself. And believe me, that's one of the greatest problems in framing any form of government, which is again why the jury was such an important component in our system of government. As our founders understood that sometimes a legislature, as wise as they might be in some cases, they might actually write a piece of legislation that violates the laws of nature and nature's God, or even violates the Constitution, the federal or state constitution. And then secondly, that the executive branch, whether a governor on the state level or president on the federal level, were to sign that, and we'd say he signs it into law, right? Not really from our founders' perspective. He signs it, quote, into law. But we know that, hey, there's another third branch of government that may weigh in on that piece of legislation and say, sorry, this is not good. This is a violation of the Constitution, and that's the judiciary. But I would argue there's a fourth branch of government that even if the judiciary, the judges say, yeah, that piece of legislation's fine, the executive and the legislative all say that piece of legislation's fine, it comes down to the citizen who's equipped, who knows the supreme law of the universe, who knows the Constitution of the federal government and state government, can evaluate a piece of legislation and say, sorry, those people got it wrong.
We're out of time. Thanks very much, David.
God bless, Dr. Stan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and I hope you enjoy our conversation with Pastor Whitney. And I hope many of you will give serious consideration to actually becoming a teacher of the Constitution. You do this through the system that they have. It's a pretty turnkey system. You simply get a kit, and there's all sorts of videos there, DVDs. You can play them. And utilize that as the basis of your instruction. There are 12 courses there, and believe me, all across America, people are learning about the Constitution again, because the people who want to establish a dictatorship hate the Constitution, they hate freedom, and they certainly hate God. Well, certainly, this is the point where I'd like to tell you about some of the things we carry. One of them is the freedom documents. and put together by Chuck Baldwin. They're all of the basic documents in one place in this book that has been put together from the Mayflower Compact up to the Gettysburg Address and everything in between that's important. There are about 40 different freedom documents there. And we think it's an important thing to have. I keep a copy close to me all the time, and you'll want to have that as well if you really want to understand the foundations of our freedom and the heritage that we inherited from generations past. The freedom documents, if you're interested in knowing more about them, our telephone number 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV. War. And then, of course, we have a number of excellent books, America's God and Government. It's written by our good friend William Federer. The Betrayal by the Bench goes in the background of the Supreme Court and its effort to destroy freedom here in the United States. And of course, it's the fact that the entire purpose of the Supreme Court has been to undermine our Constitution in many respects. Oh, they talk about our Constitution, but they have certainly totally distorted the First Amendment and the meaning of the First Amendment. And although this is an excellent book, it's probably the best single book written on the subject of the Supreme Court. You cannot understand anything about the Supreme Court's decision on Roe versus Wade, the decision having to do with the First Amendment and taking God and prayer out of our schools, unless you understand that the Masons, who worship a different God, control the United States Supreme Court from 1941 to 1971 in majorities of 5-4 to 8-1. And these Supreme Court justices were put into the court there to disrupt our nation and destroy the Christian faith of this country have done a pretty good job of it. Now, if that's true, why has nobody told you about it? Well, you can go up on the Internet and type in, Google in Supreme Court justices, Masons, and you'll get the list of them. You'll find out what I've told you is true. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, because we go into the background of this. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. And, of course, you can only understand then what energizes the Masons and these people who worship the great architect of the universe by understanding my talk on the forbidden secret. Because there is a secret that's been passed down through the ages, and you need to understand it's a DVD. There's a syllabus that comes with that. And now we're hearing even more about this secret. Rhonda Burns has had it featured on the Oprah Winfrey Show and on Larry King, and certainly Jim Carrey has talked about how this is such a wonderful thing, and he's been able to use this secret power to get ahead and amass a great fortune. Well, let me suggest, of course, that you really need to get the four-tape or four-CD set, The Secret Behind the Secret. The Secret Behind the Secret. And, of course, that will take you on into the subject of the supernatural. We have a four-tape or four-CD set on that. We have a book that goes with the tape set. It's called The Beautiful Side of Evil. It's the story of Joanna Michelson, who was a medium, and her experiences as she delved into the supernatural power and then, of course, the realization of what she was really participating in. You need to get our videos. They sold their souls for rock and roll, the 3-hour, 4-hour, 10-hour version. And, well, we're involved in a spiritual battle, ladies and gentlemen, and most people don't understand that. We hope that you will. We hope you'll join us in this epic struggle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And we need to be reminded of the views that are expressed here and not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Jim Gilchrist. We've had Jim on before. He was involved with the Minutemen for a time. He certainly is involved today in trying to stop the illegal immigration that is being encouraged by our great tax-exempt foundation, specifically the Ford Foundation, that is being encouraged by people at the highest levels of our government who refuse to enforce our immigration laws because they have a different agenda. And, of course, they really want to merge the United States and Mexico and Canada into a nation, the North American Union. But they don't want the American people to understand that. And so, of course, they go through the make-believe little game of trying to catch people at the border, but they refuse to build a fence. They refuse to enforce our laws as far as people hiring illegal immigrants, and of course they're doing everything they can to promote illegal immigration because they want a multilingual, multicultural society where they can play various groups against one another, the blacks against the Hispanics against the white, and because that's how you control. You divide, you conquer, you're able to manipulate the population. Well, Jim Gilchrist, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Dr. Stan, thank you for having me on your program.
Well, certainly, apparently, there's been some articles recently in the Washington Times telling what a great job that they're doing down in the border, how the people of the Border Patrol are really doing better at catching more of the illegal immigrants than ever before. What's the real truth about what's going on the border today?
Well, Dr. Stan, essentially, the borders are no more protected today than they were on 9/11. There's still about one-third of the manpower needed on that southern border alone to certainly guarantee its security. The United States Border Patrol has about 12,000 Border Patrol agents. They really need to go to 36,000. That's a tripling of the manpower and womanpower, the boots on the ground. In addition, a fence is sorely needed if you want to secure the border, if you want to pretend that it's secure and just tell the public that everything is under control, boys and girls, just go away, fine. But reality, in my opinion, is that unless you actually put a physical barrier down there, a Israeli-style fence, and triple the manpower, boots on the ground down there with Border Patrol, you're not going to thoroughly secure that border.
And, of course, then you have to, of course, take away all the incentives for people to come, the free medical care they can get in many places in the country. They can get, certainly welfare and food and the subsidized housing and subsidized education if they're going to university. Why would any country want to actually encourage people to break their laws? That doesn't make sense.
A number of reasons, Dr. Stan. In my opinion, first of all, we're dealing with a calamity that incrementally took hold of the United States, established its roots back in the mid-60s when Senator Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts and the late President Lyndon B. Johnson essentially dismantled the enforcement of our immigration laws. To talk about that, transnational corporations and domestic corporations are engaged in what I refer to as the 21st century slave trade, importing and luring as many impoverished people from all around the world who will work for literally peanuts.
Hold that thought, Jim. Yes. I'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess Jim Gilchrist. We're talking about illegal immigration. Jim is saying that he feels that many of our major corporations you know, are actually encouraging the illegal immigrants to come so that they can suddenly get them to work for little or nothing, or very, very little, as he used the term, peanuts. In other words, to drive the wages down so they don't have to work, hire expensive, American laborers. They can utilize the Mexicans for all sorts of jobs here, and they'll work for very little, and they will not demand all the benefits that an American worker would. But Jim, certainly, it's got to be something more than that, because if the government was enforcing the laws that have been in place for 20 or more years, this would be a serious crime, and the people who own these companies, these transnational companies that were hiring the illegal immigrants, faced imprisonment for long periods of time. That would soon discourage them from hiring illegal immigrants, wouldn't it?
Certainly, Dr. Stan, and that has been the source of the problem all along, has been the dereliction by our political governors to see to it that these laws that have been on the books forever aren't simply enforced. We really don't need any new laws. If we were to enforce all existing laws, we wouldn't have anchor babies. You might have a few, but you wouldn't have a million anchor babies a year. What do I mean by anchor babies? Well, that's where illegal alien parents come into the United States, or just the mother, for the purpose of birthing their child and getting automatic U.S. citizenship for their child. And they somehow assume that since their child is born here, they now have a firm anchor in the United States and no one can throw them out. I disagree. Under the rule of law, the parents would be immediately deported, and they would have a choice: take their U.S. citizen child with them, or leave that child under the custody of legal U.S. residents, or leave them as a ward of the state. Either way, they have a choice. 95%, in my opinion, of parents are going to take their children with them. And yes, they can take a U.S. resident child here and go back to China, Russia, Mexico, Canada, France, wherever they came from, and certainly that child would be a U.S. citizen, but if they want to keep in close contact with the child, they would have to take the child back to them, back with them. And yes, it sounds harsh, it sounds maybe cruel and unusual, but that's in the perspective of those who want to convince us that immigration is a good thing. Immigration without any screening process is a
good thing.
Hold that
thought, Jim. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Jim was just talking about anchor babies. It's when a pregnant woman comes to the United States specifically so she can have a child here in the United States, born in the United States, that child becomes an automatic citizen, and then the parents expect to be allowed to stay here. After all, they can't leave their child and leave. Well, Jim is suggesting that the family should be deported, and then they would have a choice, either to take the child with them, who is an American citizen, or certainly to leave it here as a ward of the state or adopt it to somebody else. And, well, of course, this is not what the game is all about. The game is you come here, your child is an American citizen, it's an anchor baby. Now you have an anchor and you can stay right here. And people are playing this game all over the country. There are a million anchor babies born in the United States every year. And this is being actively encouraged by the people who would change the structure of our society. And illegal immigration is being used to do that. Jim was talking about how everything began to change in the mid-1960s when Ted Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson suddenly began to dismantle the enforcement of our immigration laws. But it was in the mid-1960s that they repealed the McCarran Immigration Act, and Ted Kennedy, certainly the man of great virtue, got up and said, look, we're going to change the immigration laws. We're going to allow people to come in from other countries. We're going to change the demographics. We're going to allow people to come, but it's not going to change the demographics of our country. I can promise you, I tell you on my word of honor, or words to that effect, that we are not going to see a lot of people coming in here from Muslim and Hindu and other countries. We're going to maintain America as it's always been. It's just going to be more just immigration laws. And Ted Kennedy, as always, was lying. The hero of Chappaquiddick was not telling us the truth. He knew, of course, what we were going to end up with was millions and millions of Muslims and millions of Hindus, because Ted Kennedy, as with so many of the elite, really want a multicultural, multilingual society. So you pick up the story there, Jim.
Sure. And Ted Kennedy, to defend his bad judgment, continues to try to convince Americans that the world is flat and that square pegs will always fit into round holes. And that's what someone does when they try to expand or contract any rationale necessary to convince someone that what they did was the right thing. And I know that's a lot of words there. It sounds like I'm blathering, but essentially Ted Kennedy is trying to defend an incredible mistake that he and President Johnson essentially made. The Minuteman Project, Dr. Stan, and myself, we are not against immigration. We are for immigration, traditional immigration under the rule of law and a respectable immigration policy. We believe in an orderly queue of legal immigrants with in prescribed numbers who have certain vocational or work set skills that the United States needs to continue as a prospering and flourishing nation, and who are also of the moral character and integrity necessary to guarantee that we will be a civilized nation for another 232 years. That is not too much to ask for. Not at all. That's no different than what a good parent expects of the people who enter his or her home.
Well, I certainly agree with that, but unfortunately, of course, there are people who have a different vision of America, and they do not want an orderly America, and they're doing everything they can to disrupt us. And certainly, with the illegal immigration, we see more gangs, we see more in the way of gang violence, we see new diseases, we see our school system breaking down because, of course, we have people who don't speak English, and we have to have special remedial classes for them. We see our healthcare system breaking down. Certainly many of our hospitals have had to close their emergency rooms because, according to federal law, anybody can go to any emergency room in the United States, and they have to take care of them whether they can afford the payment or not. And certainly, why should somebody who's here illegally pay for their health care when they can get it for nothing? All they have to do is say, you know, we don't have any money, and the health care system, the emergency room, can't report these people who are here illegally. And of course, many of our emergency rooms have gone bankrupt. Many of our hospitals have gone bankrupt. Many of the hospitals are actually closing down because they cannot, of course, afford the burden of the illegal immigrants. So have you run into this problem, Jim, in your study of what's going on?
Yes, roughly in California alone. That's just one state, of course, the largest populated state in the country. California alone, with about 15% of the U.S. population, has in the last 12 years has had almost 100 emergency centers and emergency rooms of hospitals and hospitals shut down due to bankruptcy. What the federal government has done is force all hospitals and medical treatment facilities to take in any patient, regardless of that person's legal status, whether they have insurance or whatever, and treat that patient. If they do not, they are subjected to a $50,000 per infraction penalty. And doctors, being of benevolent, intrinsically are benevolent kind of people. Almost every doctor I've ever met, actually every one I've ever met, is, you can tell, they're very benevolent people. They're very caring people. And they will choose to let the hospital go bankrupt by running out of money and serving the needs of those who are in need, rather than going bankrupt by turning away those who are going to put economic unwanted and unwarranted economic pressure on the facility. Rather than turn those people away and get sued into bankruptcy by the federal government, they'll just continue providing the services as benevolent martyrs of their profession, and then just have the facility go out of business that way. It's a better way to go out. If you're going to go out, going to go bankrupt, it might as well be altruistically rather than allegedly mean-spiritedly by being fined out of business. And unfortunately, I'm in favor of cutting off all these types of benefits from illegal aliens completely. Education, medication, housing, except in the case of life-saving medical treatment. We're not going to let people die in the street. We're just not going to do that. But any medical treatment, even for that situation, should be immediately billed to the country of origin of that illegal alien. For example, if they come over here, they get hit by a bus, and they're in the hospital for 6 months because they have a broken spinal cord or whatever, and it requires all types of therapy and treatment, and you've got a bill of $1.8 million by the time you're done. And they're from the Ukraine. You betcha Russia will get a bill for $1.8 million, and if they don't pay it, well, we'll cut it out of their any foreign aid benefits that we have going their way. And I don't know if we do, but there's something like some method like that. And we can solve this problem if we have enough people in Congress willing to accept the challenge, willing to understand, look, we have a problem. We have a problem here. We've got an overburdened, an overtaxed society. Where both parents now are working, and in some cases, both parents and the kids now have to work just to maintain a reasonably dignified lifestyle, middle class, lower middle class. And all that can change if we change our priorities. And the priority should not be trying to draw and lure as many impoverished people from around the world into the United States to displace our current middle class workers and lower middle class workers. And simultaneously, not only do the illegal aliens join our economically deprived population and rely on taxpayer subsidies throughout most of their entire lives, but also the workers that they have displaced now become part of that population. So for every 10 million illegal alien workers that come in here, displacing 10 million American workers, you've got 20 million now impoverished non-workers or underemployed workers or extremely low-waged, unskilled, low-paid workers. And those low-paid workers are going to need medical, they're going to need housing, they're going to need welfare, they're going to need education for the kids, and they're going to need food stamp subsidies, so on so forth. We eventually become a mirror reflection of Mexico with 5% of the population controlling 99% of the wealth and the other 95% of the population fighting over the remaining 1% of the wealth. A little bit oversimplified example, but it's tantamount to what's happened in Mexico, Central America, and in other third world countries. And one final thing, there are 6.6 billion people in the world, Dr. Stan. Half of them are impoverished. 3.3 billion people would just love to come here at will and take part in our what I call the world's largest welfare benefit program. It's a global benefit program. Anybody who wants to use it, just come on in here and apply for it, and we will give it to you, even if we have to borrow trillions of dollars from foreign banks without the knowledge of the U.S. taxpayers, because we will not dare increase their current tax burden because they will recall us or vote us out of office. The transnationals love it. They laugh all the way to the bank. Meanwhile, the displaced American worker and his family cries all the way to the poorhouse. Now, why do the transnationals and the politicians get along so well on this? And domestic corporations who are engaged in this activity? Well, it's because they fund a lot of the reelection campaigns for these public officers, public officials. And it seems over the last 40 to 50 years that our political governors no longer represent Americans in general. They represent the transnational corporations. They represent churches who want to lure as many impoverished people or foreigners here without any vetting process, whether they should be here or not, just to get them not only to save their souls, but to get access to them as worshipers and donators to their churches. I'm a baptized Catholic. The Catholic Church is renowned for engaging in this encouraging of illegal alien invasion of the United States.
Well, if you'll hang on there, we're going to be back in just a moment. I agree with you, and I think we have a very real problem when our churches are willing to violate the laws of our land. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest Jim Gilchrist. What about this article that appeared in the Washington Times saying that suddenly there's been a dramatic drop in the number of people coming across the border because the Immigration and Naturalization Service was doing such a good job in apprehending people, now doing a much better job than before. Is there any truth to that, or is that simply a lot of propaganda being put out by the Washington Times to confuse the American people?
I think it's more propaganda than truth. Do I have unimpeded access to the law enforcement organization's information? No. Do I have a feeling that our government would rather lie to us than tell us the truth? Yes. It's not that the Border Patrol agents and the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is responsible for the internal enforcement of our immigration laws, as well as other things with our customs at seaports and airports, but it's not that they're doing their job, but it is that they are deliberately underfunded by predominantly the United States Senate, so that they cannot possibly thoroughly do their job. I would submit that the government is lying. I still feel that there are at least 5 million illegal aliens entering the United States unapprehended every year. That's every year, and going up just from our southern border alone. And I arrive at that number by taking the estimates from the United States Border Patrol as to how many illegal aliens on the southern border with Mexico alone are apprehended, as opposed to how many come through. The Border Patrol says they apprehend 1 out of 4 to 1 out of 5. In some areas, only 1 out of 10. So roughly 1 out of 4 or 1 out of 5. And the last 2 years, they apprehended 1.25 million each year for the last 2 years. That means at least 5 to 6 million have penetrated into the United States undetected through our southern border alone. No one knows who they are, where they are, or what their intentions are. And then you add to that, who knows, an uncounted number from the Canadian borders and our Pacific and Atlantic seaports. No one really has a valid estimate as to how many are coming in through those three sides of the United States. But it's much less than what's coming through, the number coming through our southern border with Mexico.
Well, you know, I think it's the most amazing thing that the Immigration and Naturalization Service really isn't trying to find out if people even who come in here legally, and I'm not talking as immigrants, but just coming in on with a visa or something, whether they ever leave. And this is one of the most amazing things. Certainly in every other country tries to control the influx and egress of people so that they know that people are not coming into their country. But here, I mean, with all of the electronic facilities that are available to the INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service, they steadfastly refuse to carry out the dictates of Congress, saying, oh, shucks, we don't even know how to do this. We're just so inept. And why aren't they simply firing the people who refuse to enforce our laws?
Apparently, they're dancing to certain orders from people that we don't know what their agenda is. I'm not one for a conspiracy theory. I still believe that Jack Kennedy was killed by one person, Lee Harvey Oswald, that there were no other shooters or no other participants involved in that assassination. I think it was one deranged man who decided to do this. But in this issue of the illegal alien invasion, the North American Union, the NAFTA, the transnational highways, the elimination of our borders, essentially.
Hold that thought for just a moment, Jim. We'll be right back.
Conspiracy.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Kristen. Our guest is Jim Gilchrist, and he says he doesn't believe in conspiracies as far as the assassination of President Kennedy, but he is very, very concerned about the effort to build the American highway. That this information is being concealed from the American people. And go ahead, say what you were going to say.
Sure, and like I said, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but in this case, for the first time in my life, the pieces seem to be fitting together. Like, it's maybe not a planned conspiracy by some underground think tank below the White House in D.C., but somehow transnational corporations, domestic corporations who have something to gain, churches who have something to gain, our school system, school administrators who get $35 a day, roughly, for every student that's in their school, regardless of their legal status in the country, the economic drivers for the people pushing this invasion is very strong. And what we need are economic drivers to reverse it. In other words, you are going to prison if you engage in this illegal alien or 21st century slave trading activity.
But of course, we refuse to enforce the laws, and there has to be a reason why high government officials, whether they be Democrat or Republican, year after year, decade after decade, refuse to enforce our laws when they promise. In fact, President Reagan promised the American people if they'd just, let him have his amnesty back in 1986, he would enforce the laws. He promised us that, and he refused to do it, and as did George W. Bush, as did Bill Clinton, and now I should say George Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, and now George W. Bush. So they all refused to carry out the laws that President Reagan promised would be enforced, and there has to be a reason behind that. That's not stupidity.
Three reasons again, and I'll start with the most prominent. First one would be the economic driver. It behooves schools, churches, businesses, anyone who has a financial stake in illegal entrepreneurship, it behooves them, benefits them to see it continue. Number two, it's vote pandering. Both parties, Republican and Democrat, are looking at the illegal alien population as a prospective voting bloc. The third and least reason is politically correct paralysis. You're not allowed to speak about that. If you do, that you are a racist, you're labeled a racist, you're labeled a xenophobe, you are physically prevented from speaking, that's happened to be. You're required to wear a bulletproof vest. I did that at Cal State University Long Beach 3 months ago with 30 cops around me, also wearing bulletproof vests and armed to the teeth, so that I could simply say to a student body of about 150 students at a campus the same thing that I'm saying on your radio program. And I'm befuddled to figure out what is it that I am saying that's supposed to be so xenophobic, so racist, so hostile, so bigoted, and I cannot find any reason to suppress my free speech. Other than anarchists do not want me to spread this word because they, like you were speaking before, there is a certain segment of our society who have their own agenda, and that agenda is not outright anarchy, but I think a good 10% of our population have so much hatred for their failures in life that they need someone to blame for it, and they blame the system, the man, the machine, and they look at conservative people like myself and yourself and Tom Tancredo and others, broadcasters and television and radio, as conservatives and as evil people, because they do not want to answer to an authority. They do not want to answer to any code of conduct. Essentially, they are anti-free speech and anti-rule of law, and that means they are anti-founding fathers. You could not get more anti-American than that, and unfortunately about 10% of our population is that way, and it comes from, I guess, that adage I was using earlier. I need somebody to blame for my failure, so I'm going to expand and contract my rationale to make sure that everybody thinks that the earth is flat and that square pegs fit into round holes. Then I'll be happy because now I'm in control. They're kind of like little Castros. And that's, so there are a number of reasons why you have these problems, but the consequence, and this is very critical, the consequence is going to be devastating. It's going to be staggering for the United States of America if we do not only stop this illegal alien invasion, but reverse it. And that means deporting millions of people who are here illegally and forcing them to stand in line in their homelands at a U.S. embassy for an orderly immigration into the United States, and millions of them, or tens of millions of them, will not be able to come back here.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Jim Gilchrist. And, of course, Jim, the difficulty we face, and certainly I would like to see all these people deported, but President Bush has no intention of deporting them. Certainly John McCain doesn't want to deport them. He wants to give them amnesty. Both the Democrat candidates, Hillary and Obama, they certainly will do nothing to deal with the illegal immigration program. So I don't see how we're going to have any change in this at all. The leaders of both the Democrat and the Republican Party are dedicated to giving amnesty to the 10 or 20, I think it's probably closer to 20 million illegal immigrants in the United States today, which will totally change the entire makeup of our society. But it seems that these people seem to have a different agenda, a different worldview,
a
different view of what America should be.
That's correct, Dr. Stan. I give no credence to, I'm a registered Republican. I put no credence in Senator John McCain to be any different than George Bush or President Clinton on this issue, or Bush 1 on this issue. I give no credence to Senator Obama or Senator Clinton to be any different. As a matter of fact, Obama and Clinton will be even worse than George Bush, but McCain won't be that much different than George Bush. A few percent better than the Democrats, but not much. Essentially, in my opinion, John McCain is really is more representative of a Democrat in his points of view. And we're talking about a Republican senator who couldn't even defend his own state against illegal alien immigration and invasion during the 18 years he was a senator there. And he's going to defend the United States against invasion and against terrorism? I don't think so.
Well, he's actually come out in favor of amnesty, so
yes.
I think that so we have to understand where he's coming from, and certainly there is no effort to protect our southern border against those wicked terrorists who want to come in here and destroy us, or maybe much of what we've been told isn't true, because if there are all these wicked terrorists who are trying to come in here and destroy our country, why haven't they been in here lighting forest fires, derailing our trains? You know, one suicide bomber at a department store would have a disastrous effect, and yet, after almost 7 years, over 7 years since the September 11th attack, the one other major terrorist attack in America, is it possible that perhaps, just perhaps, what we've been told is not exactly true? Well, we're going to be back in just a moment with Jim Gilchrist as we talk about why we're not guarding our borders, why we're not protecting America from the illegal immigration that's taking place today. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jim Gilchrist. But before we go on, Jim, do you have a website or any sort of a book? Now, you'd written a book along with our good friend Jerome Corsi on the Minutemen. We actually carry that book. And has that book moved pretty well?
The book is called Minutemen, The Battle to Secure America's Borders, co-authored by Dr. Jerome Corsi and myself about a year and a half ago. Our website is MinutemanProject.com. And if you want to visit us at MinutemanProject.com, we're as close as your nearest computer. And get on our website. You can email me or give me a direct phone call to my desk. I can't answer all the calls, but you can leave me a message. I'd be glad to hear from you. This is my opinion. What I see in the future is that we certainly have no presidential candidate. It looks like it's going to be McCain for the Republicans and Obama or Hillary for the Democrats. Neither of them winning the presidency is going to make any difference insofar as our immigration policy. We're going to continue being invaded. It's going to be up to citizen groups like Minuteman Project to keep bringing national awareness to this issue and making a big deal about it. We're talking about the loss of our sovereignty, our heritage, our history, our language. At the current rate of invasion, currently there are about 35 million illegal aliens here. 3.5 years ago, there were 20 to 21 million. It's gone up dramatically, about 75% since then. But at the current rate of invasion of over 5 million illegal aliens every year and going up, by the year 2025, Dr. Stan, there will be more illegal aliens from all around the world occupying U.S. territory than there will be citizen voters, and the consequences are going to be staggering. We're going to have a cowering, weak-kneed Congress facing off with as many as 120 to 150, some pundits say 215 million illegal aliens, which will represent a little over 40% of our population at the time. They will be facing off with our Congress demanding not only amnesty, but automatic citizenship, and a cowering Congress will wave their magic congressional wand and say, poof, you're all citizens. And then it gets worse, because when you have 80 or 100 million out of that 150 million or 200 million illegal aliens who are from Mexico and Central America, they're going to be putting into candidacy for our U.S. Senate, our mayors, our governorships, our House of Representatives, state and federal, etc., candidates who, some of whom just came across the border the day before to get amnesty today. They're going to put them into office. They're going to be supporting candidates in Mexico and the United States running on identical platforms. And essentially, it's going to be a living example of the tail, Mexico, wagging the dog, the United States. And by sheer numbers, they are going to seize our infrastructure. This will be incrementally over a few more decades. Maybe it's by the year 2035, it'll be complete. Where English, by the year 2030, you're going to see the first attempt to introduce a bill into Congress trumping English with Spanish as the national language, because Spanish will have become so dominant, because we're not insisting that English be the common language of the country. We might be insisting, but we're not doing anything about it to prevent Spanish from overwhelming English as the dominant language. And we're going to pay a very dear price. And the price is tantamount to forgetting that you have a last name, that you have ancestors, that you have grandparents. There are two types of Americans, Dr. Stan. Two types. One type pledges its allegiance to the almighty greenback and all the power that money can buy. And the other type are your real Americans. And those are the type who pledge their allegiance to the United States of America and all the priceless principles for which it has stood for 232 years. I put you and myself in the latter category. Unless we get stronger and get more verbal and audible and demanding, in a peaceful way, in a respectful way, under the rule of law, we're going to lose this country. And it's going to be something that we do not recognize anymore. And it's going to be a literal mirror reflection of a third world country. And history has shown me that there are two ways to seize the country, either by military force with guns blazing and bayonets fixed, or by a covert Trojan horse invasion with the host country, the target country, the United States in this case. You transfer in most of your population into that country, and you seize its infrastructure over several decades, starting with its educational system, its police departments, its jobs, into the political offices, et cetera, so on and so forth, where you literally convert it to what your country that you came from used to be. And it's easily done. When you transfer 50, 80, 100 million people, let's say, from Mexico over a 50 to 60-year period, because they're producing at twice to three times the rate American mothers are producing children at, it's easy to overwhelm a country by sheer numbers. And it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to dislodge that illegal population when they become that large in numbers. And essentially, that's my take on what's happening to the United States. Again, these are all my opinions or my observations. I stand by them. If you want to hear more, visit us at MinutemanProject.com.
All right. Well, I think you've expressed it very, very well. I share your concern. I can remember 1988. It was here I ran for Congress as Republican congressional candidate for the 16th District. But it was that same year that Senator Hayakawa from California was a Japanese-American citizen and a good American, put forward legislation in the United States Senate that English was to be the official language of the United States, and it seemed like it was such a logical thing to do. After all, it's a language that draws a nation together, a common language, a common culture, a common desires, a common religion, and certainly whether we be a Catholic or Protestant, we're certainly all Christians, predominant of religion, only 1 or 2% Jewish in our nation. But you see, back in 1988, Senator Hayakawa couldn't understand why there was so much opposition to having English as the official language of the United States, because Senator Hayakawa and some of the other senators that supported him didn't understand that there was another agenda. And there really is, Jim. I've been to the headquarters of the Council on Foreign Relations at 58 East 68th Street in New York City on a number of occasions, spent many weeks going through their publications. Every Secretary of State for 50 years has come from the organization. Every head of the CIA, every director of the CIA, every chairman of the Federal Reserve System. We have a one-party system with two branches, one Republican, one Democrat, but the overall control is not in Washington, D.C., but rather at 58 East 68th Street in New York City. I've been there. I've talked to them. I've been through their files. They know exactly what they're doing, and their dedication is to the destruction of the sovereignty of our nation and bringing about a one-world government, and that's why they want a multicultural, multilingual society. They do not believe in America. They do not believe in sovereignty. They have a different worldview, which, of course, in my estimation, is a view that is treasonous because they want to destroy the sovereignty of this wonderful nation that you and I love. Well, Jim, how are we going to reach the American people and let them understand that if they're not involved, the other side will be? And if we do not change things, then we will lose America and the freedom we've enjoyed.
I encourage every American to start a group similar to the Minuteman Project in their hometown, in the community. You can start a group of one or a 100,000. If you want to be a Minuteman Project chapter, we'll let you tag on to us and use our logos and reference. We don't charge anything. We want to continue bringing the issue. We want people to speak at universities and colleges and high schools. We want them to write letters to the editor. We want them to write books on this issue. We want them to pressure their political governors, whether they be a dog catcher or a city mayor or a councilman or a state governor. Pressure them. Keep pressure on constantly. It requires constant vigilance to bring this issue to the forefront of debate. Otherwise, we are going to lose the country. It's something we've probably fallen away from over the last 40 to 50 years. Politics is not a very interesting topic to most people. They just want to get on with their lives. But it also is not a spectator sport, which it has somehow become. As we become more technologically advanced, I think people read less about what's happening in their communities, about the threat to their children, about the drug infestation, the crime, and comparing the fact that in 1917 there were only 261 murders in the United States, one for every 330,000 people. Today there's a murder for almost every one in, I believe it's 18,000 people. You're 35 times more likely to be murdered today than you were 90 years ago. That's amazing. 30 times more likely to be murdered today than you were 90 years ago.
Well, this is an entirely different world than the world I grew up in.
Yes.
78 years ago, 79 years ago. And certainly those days, why, of course, people feared God. We had prayers in our schools. We had patriotism. We had men whose word was as good as their bond. But that's all changed. The very moral structure of our society has changed. Our educational system has changed. Our children are not allowed to read the Ten Commandments in schools. And it's against the law to post the Ten Commandments in our schools, because if the children, at least according to the Supreme Court, were to read those Ten Commandments, it wouldn't do any good unless they meditated upon them, they might obey them. And if they were to obey the Ten Commandments of God, why, of course, it would be a violation of the wall of separation between church and state. And I would like to suggest, what sort of madness is this? They're teaching our children in school that they are the determinant of what's right and wrong. They have to learn how to make decisions. What a 14-year or 15-year-old child can make intelligent decisions? We're not allowed to discipline our children. They get their discipline when they get into prisons and, of course, through gang rape and through beatings. Why, eventually, of course, they begin to realize that there are rules and you better follow them. Well, what a terrible way. Wouldn't it be far better if they were disciplined in their homes? But we don't allow discipline in the homes. We don't allow disciplines in the schools. We have an entire change in the structure of our society, and nobody ever asks why.
Yes, and people are living underground, literally, in fear of their government. The government has been so big, gotten so big, and so untrustworthy that many of us no longer recognize this monster that we call a U.S. government. We're living in fear of it. We live behind closed doors. And it seems like, this may sound a little bizarre, but it seems like lawlessness is certainly overcoming the lawful. Many reasons. A lack of commitment to a lack of philosophy towards what is good and what is evil, of being able to determine and judge between good and bad. Emphasis of so-called philosophers at university levels in high schools now, teaching the children that nothing really matters. They're bringing all their baggage from their childhood into the classroom. Certainly, in going into wars that we never intended to win, like Korea and Vietnam perhaps even Iraq, going into these long, stretched-out wars. We've been in Korea now for over 50 years, 53 years, I believe it is, or 56 years. We went in there, actually 58 years. We went in there in 1950.
Right.
And the public in general is getting tired of it. I can see where they're getting the anti-war attitude, because we seem to start wars and then we either cut and run or we stay there forever and put that burden on taxpayers. And it gets very confusing as to, well, aren't we a nation that supposed to be isolated from war, but we will stand up and defend ourselves if we're attacked? Whatever happened to that concept? Now it seems like we go around looking for places to start wars. I'm a Vietnam veteran from the Marine Corps. Got my Purple Heart there. I would not have missed that tour in the Marine Corps and in combat for $1 million, but I can assure you I would never do it again for $1 billion. And that was... perhaps that's just one thing. There seems to be one reason why I think people are turned against their own government. There's that feeling that they've been left out, many of us. And with this, what do you call the one world government concept? Before I say anything, I want to say, if it's true, it ain't bragging, and it's not a conspiracy. If it's true, and I think it is true, that there is some concerted effort by your multi-zillionaires in the world to take advantage of the poor, to certainly protect their assets and their gold bullion, and the only way they're going to do that is to ally themselves globally. You have the incredibly ultra-wealthy in the United States with the incredibly ultra-wealthy in South America and Asia and Europe and Africa. All these incredibly ultra-wealthy organizations or people, eventually, I think you're going to see, will comprise the world government. And they will kind of control us, the entire world, the way a country or a state controls its population. They will control the police forces. You get into trouble, I'll send my country's troops over to help your country so that I can protect your assets. And the concern really won't be for my men and women who are going into battle to protect your country, because we want to protect your money. Kind of a far-fetched concept, but I can see it coming maybe over the next 100 years.
Well, I hope it's... 100 years off. I think it's much closer than that. I think we're moving very rapidly towards the sort of government they have in Russia, where, pardon me, it's a government they have in Mexico, where they really have a number of billionaires. They have more billionaires in Mexico than all the rest of South America put together.
Yes, the richest man in the world lives in Mexico City.
But
he owns the telecommunications industry in Mexico.
But of course, what we're really seeing is you have, a very powerful oligarchy, and then you have a powerful police and military that is used to maintain the situation there. You had a one-party rule. Recently, they had, of course, people from the opposition party who were allowed to win, but they were really pushing exactly the same agenda. It's sort of like it is in America. You've got two political parties, both controlled by the same people, both with the same goals and objectives. That's the way it is in Mexico, except that you have certainly a very large peasant class, a very large group of poor people. And, of course, that's where we're moving as well. America's wealth is being distributed throughout the world, and we're moving to impoverish the American people, not by accident, but by intent, right here. Well, Jim, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program. Well, what parting thought would you like to leave with our listeners?
To tell America that to stand their ground and remember, we have this priceless power, this power invested in us by our founding fathers, called the First Amendment, essentially. Freedom to assemble peacefully and freedom to speak. And I urge every American to exercise their freedom to assemble and speak peacefully and respectfully and bring forth debate on whatever you feel threatens your domestic tranquility. It doesn't have to just be illegal immigration. It could be pleading for a fair tax system. I would love to see our tax system be replaced by a fair tax, and never again in your life would you have to file an income tax return and spend 2 weeks doing it. The thing is so big now. And if our political representatives do not want to cooperate, then I say if our political governors want a war, then we will fight them with the First Amendment and within the rule of law, and we won't quit. And that's my parting shot for your audience.
All right, Jim. Well, I appreciate everything you do. I certainly always enjoy having you on our program. We've enjoyed your book, The Minutemen. What's the exact title?
Minutemen, The Battle to Secure America's Borders. And if you want to get in touch with me, visit me at MinutemanProject.com. I'm the founder and the president of the Minuteman Project. And by the way, we've done more to bring this national awareness to this issue in 3 years than a dozen much larger organizations have been able to do combined in 20 years. I'm proud of that. And if it's true, it ain't bragging. Thank you.
Thank you for everything you do, Jim. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And, of course, our guest has been Jim Gilchrist of the Minuteman Project. And Jim is certainly on the front lines of this battle. There are other organizations out there, but I really think that Jim spends more time getting the information out and is really a very, very effective, spokesman for his point of view. But I would add, I believe there is a conspiracy. I believe there are people who have a different worldview, have a different agenda, and are using illegal immigration as a means of destroying the infrastructure of our society and creating a state where we're going to have increasing strife as they play the various racial and lingual groups one against the other. That's how you establish an effective dictatorship. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and certainly this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you agree with me that we're involved in this spiritual battle, we hope many of you, if you're in a position to, will join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us as we reach out 5 hours every day at almost 60 outlets of one sort or another every week, bringing the message of truth that people are not going to get from other sources. Now, I would simply suggest, if you'd like more immigration information on the immigration, why we carry both the book, The Minutemen, We carry the book, The Late Great USA. They're both excellent books on immigration. We have another one, Fighting Illegal Immigration. And then, of course, we have 2 4-tape sets on immigration. We carry a DVD put out by our good friend Glenn Spencer. It's titled The Conquest of Aztlan. The Conquest of Aztlan. And it tells about, of course, these Mexican groups that really want to annex California, New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, and I believe Florida, and return them to where they should be, under the control of Mexico. You have to understand that this is a pipe dream. The real goal is to unite Mexico and the United States and raise the living standards of the average American to that of the Mexican peasant, as we intentionally redistribute the wealth of the American people. Now, this is a plan. You can read it. It's called the Earth Charter. You get it off the Internet. If you don't have access to the Internet, you can call us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like a copy of the Earth Charter, which is kept in the Ark of Hope, which is the Luciferian counterpart of the Ark of the Covenant. And just as the Earth Charter has been said to be the new Ten Commandments, it is in truth the Luciferian counterpart of the Ten Commandments that were given by God to Moses. Understand that behind everything going on is this Luciferian program to bring about a world government. And this has always been the program, going back to the time when Nimrod tried to unite the world and, of course, built the Tower of Babel, but it never got completed. However, you can go to Strasbourg today, and you'll actually see there the building where the European Parliament meets from time to time. And what is it? Why is it a building that's architecturally designed to represent the incomplete Tower of Babel? And the European Union is the fulfillment of Nimrod's ancient plan to unite all of Europe. Of course, the plan is to unite the United States, Mexico, and Canada here, the North American Union, to have a similar union in South America, Africa, Asia, certainly in the Central Asia, and then, of course, the Pacific Rim countries. And once these countries have given up their sovereignty to trade unions, why, then they can unite them all into the New World Order with a New World Religion and enthrone the New World Leader. It's part of a long-range plan, and certainly illegal immigration is part of that. If you'd like to understand how this is financed, you need to get the book Foundations, Their Power and Their Influence. That's Foundations, Their Power and Their Influence. We carry the book Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, long suppressed by people who don't want the American people to know the truth, but eventually, of course, being printed today by one of my friends. And, of course, Tragedy and Hope tells the history of the secret society that controls America today. And you read about this on pages about 950 to about, the end of the chapter there. You really want to read about it. There really is a secret society. Of course, it has a front organization. It's known as the Council on Foreign Relations. The Council on Foreign Relations. Remember, the book is available, as is Foundations, as the other items, by calling 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening at the same time, may the Lord be with you.